Hello again. This is Eva starting the first distance English program of the two made for course 5.
And this is Maini. Hi everybody. This time you will hear some new voices. We have Simon, Kalevi and Matti here in the studio with us.
According to the national syllabus, some of the topics expected to be presented are the media, technology and international affairs, among others. Simon will first tell us something about popular TV cartoons.
Then, Kalev is going to interview Simon on the development of cars, especially environmentally friendly ones.
And then Simon will ask Matti a few questions on the EU.
The grammar contents in this course are the use of the infinitive, the inform, and the so-called shortened sentences. But now, welcome, Simon. The floor is yours.
Cartoon series are favourites of young and not-so-young TV viewers. Although seemingly meant for children, mothers and fathers alike enjoy watching them. The Moomins is a good example. Despite the huge success the Moomin family has had in print in its home country, it would have been practically impossible to predict how well-liked the TV cartoon series would become worldwide. The real craze started with the success of the animated Moomin World TV series, produced in the 1990s in cooperation with a Japanese company, which, by the way, still owns the distribution rights. The international popularity of the Moomins is probably due to the fact that this funny-looking, cuddly, soft-formed family and their company is far enough from normal human looks, while truly human in nature. They are like people in their way of thinking, talking and dealing with each other. Yet they cannot be associated with any particular race or nationality, although we can find features typical of human beings in them. What still adds to the charm of the series is the world which the Moomin trolls inhabit, a rural landscape which, again, resembles more a fairy tale world, being strange and slightly dangerous and familiar at the same time. The environment is said to appeal especially to the Japanese, who find the tranquility of Moomin Valley extremely charming as a contrast to the busy life in the midst of city skyscrapers and heavy traffic. Some of you may remember the time a few decades ago when Donald Duck was banned as amoral because he didn't wear trousers, and imperialistic because he was said to propagate demoralising Western values. In the same way, Enid Blyton, one of the world's most successful children's authors and among Britain's most translated writers, do you remember ever reading the famous Five, Vesico, was framed and vilified in the 70s. The accusation was that many of her characters in her stories were not politically correct, and her classic Toryland stories about Noddy the puppet and his friends Big Ears and Tessie Bear were seized on as epitomes of colonial, sexist and racist propaganda because of gollywag characters and Blyton's treatment of girls. But times change, and so do the audiences. Now, more than 30 years after Blyton's death, and over 100 years after her birth, there have been a considerable turnaround for her work. True enough, the books she wrote in the 40s and 50s have been revised and edited, and the stories used for a British TV cartoon series were shorn of all unacceptable elements. And now, after the writer's rehabilitation, Noddy from Toryland is ready to go west, which has been an unconquered frontier. The producers expect the American audience to fall for the little boy who gets in trouble and makes adults be the baddies. It is not of little importance either that Americans are nowadays deeply concerned about violence, and that is why the innocent stories are hoped to work as an antidote. But the borders are not easily crossed, even between countries sharing a common language. To refresh the stories, new Toyland characters have been created for the series, a mixture of animation, live action and puppetry. Existing characters from Blyton's other stories also appear, and last but not least, Noddy's British English is not believed to sell well enough. Therefore, the characters have had to learn an American English accent, and, for example, to learn to use wrench instead of a spanner. Then, only then, will the US market be not jolly good, but simply super. What I have dealt with so far is more or less children's cartoon series. But over the years, many TV cartoons have come up and become real cult series for young adults. A very popular one still run is The Simpsons. If you only scratch the surface, they seem to be like any average American family. Father Homer, Mother Marge, and the kids Bart or Bartholomew, Lisa and Maggie, plus Santa's little helper, the dog. But it is the way they treat each other and talk to one another that makes them so hilariously different from everyday family series, not to speak of their appearances. Very much of what was said about The Simpsons applies to its successor in success, the MTV cartoon Beavis and Butthead, which has been regarded by some as the nadir of idiot comedy, and by others as the apex of pop culture metacriticism. Whatever the truth, the genre is alive and still going strong. An example of this is the cult US cartoon series South Park. Although the language and behaviour of the previous cartoons can't be considered a paragon of good demeanour, South Park goes even further. The following programme has coarse language and, due to its content, should not be viewed by anyone, the warning goes. South Park starts where The Simpsons leaves off. The characters are at the same time lovable and disgusting, hilarious and frightening. The four main characters are all boys. Stan Marsh, the star quarterback for the South Park Cows, American football team. Kyle, a Jew who enjoys playing kick the baby with his kid brother, Cartman, who eats disgusting mixes of chocolate chicken pot, happy tarts and cheesy puffs. Kenny is the character wearing an anorak whose hood covers his mouth, preventing his voice from being heard. The topics dealt with in the episodes are far from ordinary. It seems to be a rule, rather than an exception, for the cartoon to try to offend. Even if the coarsest swear words were dropped after the pilot was presented, there are a lot left, and the scenes may include anything from a Halloween celebration with a child wearing a Hitler's costume, performing in it, to a lesbian schoolteacher being kidnapped by Arabs and shot by a rocket into the sun. A surprising fact is that there have hardly been any complaints from concerned parents or the audience, either about the contents or the language. The reason may be that the warning has done the job, and the cartoon is mainly watched by teens or 20-somethings, continuously searching for the next exclusive fraternity. South Parkies are apparently old enough not to be controlled by their parents, whereas the cult is mainly being spread via the internet. On the other hand, is all this as harmless as it seems to be, if newspapers and magazines feel the need to hire psychiatrists to analyse the cartoon characters at the same time asking, what can we learn about our own kids from this?
The search for alternative motor fuels has been going on for some time, as have the tests to make commuters and others who don't drive for a living change their petrol or diesel cars for more environmentally friendly and economical ones. One of these so-called new options is the electricity-run version. But is it not such a new invention at all, or is it, Simon?
No, not really. As a matter of fact, the year 1997 marked the centenary of the first electric cab used on the streets of London. The cabbies, who had first been instructed how to manage the switches, had to undergo what must have been Britain's first driving test about 40 years before this became compulsory for private motorists.
Did these new cabs become popular?
Yes, customers liked the battery taxis. The Prince of Wales, later Edward VII, was among the first passengers, and according to an old advertisement, among the other users were Her Majesty the Queen, the Dowager Empress of Russia, the Sultan of Morocco, and the Earl de Grey. Cleanliness and quietness were the vehicle's best points. According to one satisfied customer, There is no shaking and rattling, and the only noise is a slight dreaming hum, like that of the insects in a shady avenue of lime trees on a hot summer afternoon.
What about the rivals, the horse cabbies?
The handsome cabbies nicknamed the newcomers hummingbirds, while the cab drivers' union was reported to be distinctly in favour of the new cab. However, the electric cabs proved very expensive and not very profitable, mainly because of the weight of the massive battery pack and the perpetual tyre trouble. And the service was withdrawn in a couple of years to be replaced later by petrol cabs.
I wonder why the world's motor industry hasn't been interested in new sources of power for cars instead of investing in the development of all kinds of fashionable gizmos.
The Arab-Israeli War of 1973 doubled the price of petrol and made people more aware than ever before of the possibility of oil running out. But it still took car manufacturers about 2 decades to become alert. Today's general public is much more concerned about pollution from petrol and diesel propulsion. Besides, more and more people are beginning to appreciate the benefits of electric vehicles, like economy, efficiency, and cleanliness. And the industry has realised what the buyers are after, and is, naturally, willing to rise to the challenge.
Every once in a while, you see articles in newspapers about test runs of electric vehicles. All kinds of delivery vans are already in more or less regular use in many cities, aren't they?
You're right, but there are many other experiments going on all around the world. In England, the city of Coventry has been one of the pioneers in changing from motor city to electric city. There are about a dozen projects going on there which have something to do with increasing the use of electric vehicles. One project concentrates on investigating the use of electricity as, could I say, alternative fuel. Another scheme aims at enhancing the popularity of electric vehicles.
What kind of uses have been suggested?
Well, one plan is to form a club which would allow members to pick up cars at certain points around the city when they need them, instead of bringing their own cars into the city centre every day. They also encourage local companies to form car-sharing pools. If, for example, 500 people switch from their own vehicles to car-sharing and public transport, it would cut commuting by more than 300,000 miles a year.
What kind of companies have joined the project?
Royal Mail, for example. And even the city council has purchased a few pool cars. You see, the trend over the years has been for staff to use their own cars and claim mileage rather than drive council-owned vehicles. And vehicles will also be available to people visiting the city, with collection points at the airport, as well as train stations and coach depots.
So far, electric cars have mostly been vans looking like milk floats. Has there been any design work done for as for how the vehicles look?
In a way, yes. These cars certainly don't look like milk floats. What is being tested is the ordinary-looking French Peugeot 106, powered by an electric motor fed by 20 nickel-cadmium batteries. If you peer under the bonnet, you will see an engine without spark plugs or a cylinder head. It rather looks like a series of computer components.
One drawback the electric car used to have was the extremely heavy battery. How has this problem been solved, or is it still being worked on?
The batteries are getting smaller and smaller. In this case, they are placed beneath the car, which reduces boot space and makes carrying a spare wheel impossible. Instead, they provide a foam inflator for temporary tyre repairs.
Recharging the batteries has been another problem, right?
Yes, and that still exists. As Royal Mail, for example, they recharge the vans at lunchtime after the morning deliveries. In the afternoon, the deliveries and collections can then be taken care of, and a full recharge takes place overnight. And the pool car can be recharged in the user's own garage. The only thing needed for refueling is a 13-amp socket.
Sounds very practical, but is electricity the only source of power that is tested today?
No, not at all. There is a lot of investigating, testing and developing going on everywhere. rapeseed fuels, biogas, a methane product, natural gas, and liquefied petroleum, to name but a few, are being tried. And the idea is also to show people that alternative fuels really work, are not dangerous, and do not lead to high maintenance costs. Of course, everything that is not mass-produced tends to be expensive. That's why the governments should also be prepared to reduce taxes on these vehicles, as well as the consumers to be convinced. The more common the new alternatives become, the lower the future costs will be.
True enough. But what are the newest inventions that are already available, but perhaps not to everybody?
Cruise control, automatic suspension, anti-lock brakes, vehicle detection radar, dashboard navigation systems, devices that call for emergency help after a crash, as well as onboard navigation systems that can tell drivers their location by reading an onboard electronic map or the signals from a global positioning satellite system.
And are you saying all this already exists?
Yes, to some extent at least, to those who can afford it.
What's there still to be expect?
Well, the eternal dream of every car manufacturer and car owner is probably as follows. A smart car will pull out of the garage, drive down local roads and head for the smart way. There it will move onto the auto lanes as the driver activates the robo-driver and relaxes. The car will be protected by collision avoidance radar and automatic brakes, with guidance coils on either side steering it down the centre of the lane. The driver, meanwhile, can recline with eyes closed and pop in some music. A network of satellite-linked computer systems will guide the car safely to the exit, where the driver will resume control.
That did sound like sci-fi. What a wonderful world, or is it? The industry should also be able to solve the problems of using automated cars on the motorways, tamed with roadhogs, drunk drivers and teenagers which think they are immortal. And what happens if a moose jumps onto the smart way? What if the driver on the auto lane steps on the brakes? What if a computer crashes? Do the cars follow suit? Or do you sue the driver, the car maker or the programmer? All this sounds remains to be seen.
Mr. Matti Murtinen is a reporter who works for Aamulehti, the second biggest newspaper, right?
Daily newspaper, to be exact.
In Finland. Matti's special field of reporting is the EU. Matti, how do you become an EU reporter? Is it that when you apply for a job in a newspaper, you are already a specialist, say, in foreign affairs? Or do you first start as some kind of jack-of-all-trades, become interested in something, and get tasks on a particular field?
Well, Simon, there are probably as many ways as there are reporters. I myself started my journalistic career as a sports writer, and later went on to work at the foreign news desk. EU matters became relevant for the Finnish media in the late 80s, and I was based in Helsinki, covering national politics at that time.
As for the EU issues, what are your sources of information?
First of all, information has to be divided into different categories. There are, for example, official and less official sources. Press releases and briefings by government or EU officials fall into the official category. Then there are also sources that you can't always identify by name, for example. In professional jargon, we talk about deep throats who feed us with scoops. Or when someone else gets the story, it's called a leak. Of course, a reporter also needs other media and news agencies, and today the internet is being used more and more. For background and analysis, we often contact independent think tanks and interview specialists or scientists, some other kind. In extreme circumstances, journalists can even use their own brains.
Matti, how do you take the different newspaper readers into consideration? Do you write different articles meant for different people, funnier, lighter texts if you wish to influence or inform younger readers and so on?
That seems to be the $1 million or the €1 million question nowadays in all fields of reporting. When you're writing a basic news story, you try to do it in a way that is comprehensible for as wide an audience as possible. But that's not always enough. These days there is a lot of demand for light-hearted stories and, on the other hand, for short, simplified pieces of information with graphics and visual elements. In that sense, TV and other electronic media have also influenced the way newspapers do their reporting. What worries me the most is that not too many people are interested in reading long and deep background articles anymore.
It has been claimed that the European Parliament does not have any real power, that it is only a rubber stamp or a puppet on the strings of the Commission and the Council of Ministers. How do you see this?
The Parliament was the big winner in the Maastricht Treaty negotiations as far as the balance of power between different EU institutions is concerned. So the European Parliament is not a rubber stamp, at least not in all areas of EU decision-making. But to make one thing perfectly clear, the European Parliament's powers are still quite modest compared to what national parliaments have in legislation of the member states.
You also hear both politicians and citizens talk about a democratic deficit at the heart of the EU. What is meant by it, and is it true?
There certainly is a deficit, but there are different views as to where the deficit really lies. Many people say that it's the Parliament's minimal powers that make the Union undemocratic. But I'd rather put it in another way. You see, the ministers in the Council are the ones that make the big decisions. The question is, can the national parliaments and voters in the member states exercise enough control over these ministers that go to Brussels in the morning and come back with a decision in the evening? This is especially worrying, bearing in mind the fact that the Council meetings are not open to the public and voting results don't need to be officially published.
By the way, what is the difference between the European Community and the European Union? You often see these names used as if they were meant the same thing. Do they?
The Union is a kind of an overall structure, and it is not a legal entity as the Community is. The Union was created in Maastricht by adding two new so-called pillars onto the side of the Community. That is, the common foreign and security policy and cooperation in the field of justice and home affairs. In these new two areas, one must note that the Court of Justice, for example, can't rule. And that is why it is still called the Court of Justice for the European Communities and not the EU Court.
A name you very often hear in the media in connection with EU issues is the European Social Fund, which, by the way, covers some of the production costs of these distance learning programs too. How does it function?
The ESF, the Social Fund, is one of the instruments the Union uses in its structural policy. Many programs are funded through the ESF, first of all to prevent people from losing their jobs, and on the other hand to help the unemployed find jobs by educating and training them.
Among the headlines very prominent in the media is the Common Agricultural Policy, CAP. Matti, could you comment on its present stage and maybe tell us how you feel about its future?
There is a lot of outside pressure on the Union to reform its agricultural policy. This will be most visible in the upcoming world trade negotiations, something that will be probably known as the Millennium Round of the WTO, the World Trade Organization. In these negotiations, the US, the United States, will strongly demand the EU to bring producer prices closer to the world market level. The most crucial question, however, is how the EU is able to absorb up to 10 new member states from Eastern Europe with its complex and costly CAP. I wouldn't be surprised if ultimately we were to face some kind of a renationalization of agricultural policy and an end to the CAP in its present shape.
A very important reason for some citizens is to become EU supporters. Is the EU having a common foreign and security policy, CFSP? Is the EU working towards a common defence?
Yes and no. No and yes. Who knows? The best person to answer this might be the next president of the United States. If the Americans decide to pull out of Europe and NATO can't be the sole security instrument anymore, then the EU simply has to start building a defense of its own. Right now, most Europeans are happy with a situation where the US guarantees the credibility of Europe's defense and carries a lot of the cost too.
Another issue that has aroused a lot of confusion and discussion was some countries joining and others not joining the Economic and Monetary Union, EMU. What were the strongest pros and cons in this debate?
In short, EMU means cost effectiveness and helps Europe in global economic competition against the US and Japan. On the other hand, there is great concern whether the one-size-fits-all monetary policy will work and serves the interests of all countries and all regions within the Eurozone. Many things remain to be seen, although right now the single currency seems to be taking off under favourable conditions.
When you look at the euro notes, you notice that the picture of a bridge has been used in all of them. The symbolism behind this must have been that bridges connect people and places. But on the other hand, some wags say another bit of symbolism should have been added. The bridge is burning, for there's no turning back from this decision. What if a country wants to leave the euro? Will it be possible?
Anything is possible. After all, many states managed to break away from the ruble zone and the Soviet Union. And if someone tries and decides to leave the euro, it will happen as a part of a big political crisis comparable to the one that resulted in the collapse of the whole Soviet Empire.
And last but not least, the directives. Everybody knows the word, and for many it's the root of all evil. What are directives, really?
A directive is a lawmaker's instructional manual. It states certain requirements which have to be met by legislation in the member states. Because most EU directives deal with the single market, they include very many details, numbers and specifications that are incomprehensible to most people. A directive is only one of the Union's legislative instruments. A regulation, for example, is already more binding. If there's a contradiction with a national law, the interpretation is simple. The EU regulation counts.
Euromythology has become part of the European diet today. In Finland, too, we've heard that curved bananas or nectarines under 55 millimetres in diameter have been banned by the EU. Where do all these stories come from, and what is the most unbelievable directive you've heard of?
I guess it's the one that says that a carrot is a fruit. And Finland was able to develop an agreement proclaiming that a reindeer is half a domestic and half a wild animal. I just wonder which end is which. So these are examples of oddities that really exist. Then there are ones that have some truth to them but don't have anything to do with the EU. Britons are very imaginative when it comes to these kinds of stories. One of the most famous is about the directive on the minimum amount of water required for a toilet bowl. Some Euro myths are myths in the pure sense of the word. Some are misunderstandings, and others are plainly and simply true.
Thank you very much for this most informative and amusing interview.
The pleasure was all mine, Simon. Hope I didn't bore anyone to sleep.